those of you who don't know me, my name is Reuven Vashnak. I'm the OU rabbi right here at Brooklyn College, OUJLIC. So, really great to see everybody here to get ready a little bit for Rosh Hashanah, for Rosh Hashanah, for the Ashkenazim, for Rosh Hashanah, for the Sephardim and Israelis here. I'd also like anybody who, invite anybody who wants for lunch over Rosh Hashanah, for that, for either one of the days of lunch, we'd love to have you. We are having a minyan in Kingsway for college students and alumni, and young professionals who are friends with alumni, and anyone who wants, we would really love to have you there or have you for lunch after the tefillot, where we have a chair with your name on it. So please let us know if you'd like to come. It would be our pleasure. I'd like to talk a little bit about Rosh Hashanah in a way that we probably haven't heard about so much. We haven't really thought about so much. There's not so many people talk about it. I want you to know, first and foremost, that every single piece of the minhagim, the customs, the mitzvot, even the words of the tefillot themselves, the tefillos themselves, even the words of the tefillos themselves are all different weapons in our arsenal that are going to keep us going for the rest of the year. They're going to give us kochot, they're going to give us strength to overcome the challenges that we're going to run into for the rest of the year. Everything that's in that machzor, and the sidurim, the shofar, even your apples and your sugar, your honey, all of those are going to give you unique spiritual, intellectual, or emotional energy to tackle the obstacles, the challenges that you're going to run into over the course of the 12 months following. So each little nuance of the day, a kol holech achar harosh, everything goes after the head. Everything follows the head. You know, if you make the observation with regard to animals, the head leads and the rest of the body follows to us bipedals. So the head indicates where we're going, even though it's all seemingly parallel. But everything follows the head. So everything which is happening on Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah, is going to give us some type of energy and inspiration to move forward. So I want to talk about the unabashed hope. The unabashed, maybe even chutzpahdik, atzbani, if you would, for those Israelis in the room. Chutzpahdik of hope. Very, what do you mean, Rabbi? I thought chutzpah is bad. Now we know the Mishnah at the end of Masechet Sotah says that at the end of days, chutzpah yasgeh. There will be great amounts of chutzpah. And they say, Maral, the Ramchal, Mekubalim, the Balei Chasidut, Chasidus, all say that there's a bad type of chutzpah and there's a good type of chutzpah. There's a good type of chutzpah because every characteristic that we have in ourselves can be swung to the upside and to the downside. Everything within us, we can point it up, we can point it down. It always depends on us. So we can use a certain amount of holy chutzpah, right? Holy chutzpah, azut, azbanyut, a certain holy amount of chutzpah. And it begins in the very, very beginning of the tefillot that we say. We say all these tefillot over and over and over again. Mincha, Arbit, Shacharit, Musaf, Mincha, Arbit, again, again, again. And in it, there's one word that shows up quite a bit in the Rosh Hashanah Tefillot, and that phrase is Uvechen. And so. And so. There is a holy tradition from the Abu Draham, David Abu Draham, one of the great Sephardic interpreters of the Siddur. He wants to show you how every word in the Tefillot actually lines up with words of Tanakh, words of the Bible. It all comes from words of the Bible, and it depends where you can draw on it from different places. So the word uvachem, says Rabbi David Abudraham, comes from a quote in Megillat Esther. Esther Hamalka. It's the most fantastic thing in the world when you think about it. That in the middle of Rosh Hashanah, we're talking about Purim. To give you a great deal of sukkah, if you think about it. We're feeling, as we would say in a little bit Yiddish, we're feeling very firm there. We're feeling very, very connected to Purim. Why? Because Esther Hamalka, in her famous moment of chutzpah, says, Uvechen avoy el ha-melech, shelo kedat, kasher avadati, avadati. I will go in to the king without permission, against the law. And what I've lost, okay, I've lost. So Rabbi David says that the four uvechens that we say in the Rosh Hashanah and before davening, in each one of those tefillot, summons the energy, as it were, summons the intent of Esther Hamalka, Uvechen Ahu El Hamelach, I will go in to see the king, Shalom Kedah, even without permission. Because she avadati. And what I've lost, he says, I've lost meaning, and a great deal of chutzpah. So, who are you? Who are you, Bashnak, to go talk to the king of all kings? Who are you? I say, me? Not just me, but you know what? Even if I'm undeserving, even if many other people have many more merits than I might, I'm coming in anyway. And I know you love me. And we say Uvechen, and it over and over and over. Check your Sidurim, check your Matzurim, keep your eyes open whenever you walk into a Beit Knesset over there, or next door to Shalei, and keep wherever you're going. Look, see how many times you see the word Uvechen. Because it carries that connotation that there's this great amount of chutzpah to have an audacity of hope. I forget who the author was who coined the term, but the audacity of hope. To have such audacity of a future. A tremendous amount of audacity. To not to limit, to allow my inner critic, my inner boundaries, to limit what blessings can possibly come in the coming year. To be a little chutzpahdik. To think about what more can be, what hopes can be, what a bigger, beautiful, more powerful world could be. The Uvechen teaches us, tells us, we're going to go in and ask for a perfected world. A world of peace, a world of berachot, a world of blessings. Even if we could say you have no right to deserve, to demand it, even to ask for it, even to fathom it, we can't even figure out how we're going to make sense of it, you know? Even the political situation in Israel, where two political parties are opposed to each other, and they both have half the votes, and neither of them can progress without the other one, but can't sit together. You don't see a clear way through, but still the audacity of hope, of positivism, to believe that change can happen, that the world we can help perfect the world, to have such unbelievable, audacious positivism. This is part of the Uvechen and the chutzpah of Rosh Hashanah. Of Rosh Hashanah. This unbelievable chutzpah. The word Uvechen. Similarly, we have a very, very interesting Kriyat HaTorah. Like I said, they're all different weapons in our arsenal. The Kriyat HaTorah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, also brings us back to this point. What is that? What is the Kriyat HaTorah on the first day of Rosh Hashanah? It's wild. It starts up in the middle of the story and it says, and God remembered Sarah Yimenu like he said he would. And then Sarah gave birth to a child, to Avram in their old age, in his old age. Says the baby Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov from Ishbitz. Rabbi Yaakov from Ishbitz. Sorry, I came home with that and telling the college story. When I was in Migdash Melech in Yerushalayim, so we had a whole bunch of Panamanians there also. And it's interesting that these Panamanians had never seen anything Ashkenazi in their lives. Like they've never had a kugel or gefilte fish or heard any Yiddish words. And some of the rabbis in Migdash, though, were Ashkenazim. So this one guy from Panamania, sorry, Panama, from Panama, that Moi, so Moi said, kept going on and talking about the Izbitzer. I'm like, Moi, what are you saying? He said, you know, your God. I said, Moi, no, not the Izbitzer, the Abisher. Abisher in Yiddish means God, and Izbitzer is the name of a town in Poland. Don't confuse the two. So there isn't so much to do with it to make Ishbit sound Sephardic, I'm sorry. But what he says is fantastic. Mekeleb Yaakov Sarala Avram Ben Lizkunav. So that Sarah gave birth to a son to Avram in his old age. Says Rabbi Yaakov, unbelievable. You know what old age means? In his old age means that when you have a dream, you have an image, you believe that something can happen. You have hopes for yourself and for your family. My mom still hasn't given up on the hope that maybe one day I'll be a doctor. You never know. She said, Rabbi Doctor, that sounds very nice. You know, Rabbi Doctor. So, when you have a hope that's been going on for a long, long time, and it's gotten old, it's sort of like you forgot about it. You sort of were misalek, if you took it out of your vocabulary, you couldn't even dream the hope. Right? You could not even dream the hope, and all of us have different things in our minds of things that people we'd like to be, hopes we'd like to see materialize. And then we get older sometimes and we give up on our hopes and our dreams. Says Rabbi Yaakov, this is the meaning of that he gave birth to his old age. In his old age, even though it was long, long ago, the hope might have even been forgotten. Like the words of Hatikva, right? It's funny not singing it. We haven't forgotten the 2,000 year dream. What does that mean? Because the nature of the world is to give up after a little while. The nature of the world is just to give up on a 2,000 year old dream. Sarah Imenu said, okay, you know, we're supposed to have children. But, you know, like in fertility technology, the doctor would say, have you considered surrogacy? And that's why when Sarah asks Hagar to be her surrogate, it's the first case of surrogacy over here. Please, maybe Hagar will be my surrogate. Maybe Hagar will be able to give birth and it'll be called for me. In that way, a surrogacy. I've given up on being able to have a child. And the Kriyat HaTorah, the laying of Rosh Hashanah, is fantastically a parsha of the Torah that tells us, don't give up on your dreams. Don't give up on the dreams which seem so far off and far away and unaccomplishable. Don't give up on dreams that you say, it's just a young child's dream. Hold on to those dreams. Don't let them go. Have that audacity of Esther HaMalkah to say, Ubechen, even though it's not Magiali, I'm going to go in Shiloh Kedat. It doesn't make any sense, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to have that chutzpah, that unbelievable chutzpah, to go in and ask, even though it's like, Etzak Ashur, how is that connected? How can you even think to ask such a thing? This is why we read the parasha, the parsha of Vashem Pakad Sarah, and then we compound it, right, in the next part we read the Haftarah, with the portion of the prophets we read, about the story of Shmuel, whose mother had a similar story. And the Gemara says both Sarah Imenu and Chana are both remembered in that same way on Rosh Hashanah, for the same thing. To say, don't let your critical mind, your inner critic, bind your hopes and dreams of what can be in the coming year.
hopes and dreams of the coming year. Don't let the critics make them small.
In the way, the words of an old Israeli song, Naomi Shemer,
absolutely, yeah.
It's a classic. So there's a great Rosh Yeshiva, for Shlomo Freifeld, who would sit by his, after the fast on Yom Kippur and sing this song over and over and over again, which is kind of funny. You have this, you know, this man in a big beard and a big black hat singing, but that's very much the point. Look how good it can be. Don't let your mind, as we say, be masiach das. Don't let your mind take it out of hand. Eliminate the possibilities of what hopes can be. Believe in the audacity of hope. That's what the Rosh Hashanah is all about. The Uvachen, the Kriyat HaTorah. Interestingly enough, the Na'od Deshe, and we're not even going to try to say his name, Nechval, Shmuel Asher Dov of Biskovitz, yeah, whatever. He says in the Sefer, he quotes a teaching from the Zohar Kadosh that combines the Uvachen to the Kiryat Yam Suf, to the crossing of the sea. And he has this whole thing how he figures it out and combines it. That's not important for right now. But he combines these Uvachens to Kiryat Yam Suf. And he says something astounding. And not so astounding that I spoke about this point. But astounding that he said in the same way. The day Yisrael has their back to the sea, the Paro in front of them, there's no way out. They cannot see a way out. Nobody thought there's any normal way out. Suddenly, you know what happened to the story? The sea splits. Nobody was thinking that was going to happen. That was outside anyone's expectations. In that same way, he says, This is what the Tefillot of Rosh Hashanah are all about. Have some such audacious hope. Nobody expected to see this split. That's like the furthest thing from my mind. Maybe God should just like smite them. We're expecting like, hey, wait, you think that's water? It's not water anymore. Okay, not exactly the plan that I had. In that same way, as we stand on Rosh Hashanah, the possibilities of blessings of the year, of what could happen, what could unfold, don't preclude any possibilities. Now that Deshev says. This is why it even says in the Tefillot. Even if you would think, maybe you've even thought that, what's there even to say? What would that be even help? But he says, now that we see, it says, we say it in the Tefillot, in the middle of the Uvachens. Give a pichon peh, and the achelim la. Give the opening of your mouth. Give us the ability to pray. Give us that audacious hope, that unbelievable positivism that even in our wildest dreams we couldn't imagine. That's part of what we're standing up and asking for in Rosh Hashanah. Let me end with a story. I told the story to everyone who was here last year. You might remember it, you might not. I loved it so much, and I told it, and then where I was for Yom Kippur, the rabbi also told it. And then I heard an appendix to the story that happened this summer. Listen to this fantastic story. So at the beginning of the Shivat Zion, in the 1900s, so people were moving to Israel, and the religious Jews not so much so, but there was a group of religious Jews, or a bunch of Hasidim, who decided to go to move to Israel. They started the town which is now called Kfar Hasidim. There's no Hasidim in Kfar Hasidim, by the way. Why is the town called Kfar Hasidim? There's no Hasidim. There are some religious national Israelis and traditional Israelis and secular Israelis. No Hasidim. why is it called Kfar Hasidim? Because there was a Rebbe whose name was Yablon of a Rebbe. The Rebbe of Yablon. He's one of the biggest Rebbes in Europe. He's a genius. He had very rich Hasidim. And he said, you know what? I believe that now the fact that we can move to Israel after the Balfour Declaration, Karen Kanemet, it's possible to move to the land of Israel. We're going to move and settle the land. We're going to farm. We're going to farm it, make an agricultural settlement. We're going to call it Kfar Hasidim. So they go and they move there. They don't know very much about farming. And the Rebbe had a lot of rich followers, so they bought the land, and they got there, and half of the people died of malaria. It was common, it was very swampy at the time. And people are going, and they're trying, nothing's working, ultimately gets taken over by somebody else. And they go very much into debt. And the Rebbe is just trying to get this settlement off the ground. Ultimately what happens, he goes to America to raise funds, and then he decides to leave it all. Nobody gives him any money. He doesn't want to go back because the rich people are looking to escape Europe now in the 30s, and there's nothing to talk about what happened to our money. Didn't know what to do. So ultimately, he goes and becomes a contractor or a real estate tycoon in California. He changes his name to Edward Nickel. And vanishes from sight. He invests improperly again and then loses all of his money. So at 60, 70 years old, he goes to college and gets a degree in psychology. And that's called a master's, a doctorate. He's living in UCLA still. And Peter, a little uncommon to have this old man with a little bit of an accent being a PhD in psychology. That's what it was. And there's a little bit of connection with the Jewish community, but nobody knows he was a Yablon Rebbe. Everybody thought that he disappeared. A funny incident from the time is that there's one person who did know his identity, and they were sitting, another Rebbe came to California after the war, and they're sitting there, and there's a fish, a Hasidic celebration, and they're sitting and they're singing, and one old Jew says, "Oh, you thought this, think this is a fish? I was by the Yablon Rebbe. And that was a fish. This is no fish." So, his friend elbows him a little bit under the table, but nobody knew that while he's sitting there, this was a Yablon Rebbe. So finally, I think it's the 1970s, and they find out that the Yablon Rebbe was actually alive and well in California. And he invited him to come back to Kfar Hasidim. And for years he's saying, no, everybody hates me. Nobody wants me back. Why would I even think to go there? But they convinced him, they convinced him. And they take him to the main, it was a kibbutz, so the main chadar ochel, the main hall where they all ate, the social hall, etc. He walks in, and all of a sudden somebody runs up to him. He said, "Do you remember me, Rebbe? My name is Tana. I have to thank you." He said, "What are you talking about? I'm a failure. We ran out of money. Half the people died. What do you mean, thank me?" She said, "The rest of my family died by the Nazis. I have 20 grandchildren. If it wasn't for you, there would be nothing left of us." And it happened again and again and again. And everyone, all the elders of the town, came over to thank him. To thank him for, despite the difficulty, really having saved all of their lives and their families. And they ultimately convinced him to move back and to be the Rebbe of Kfar Hasidim for his last, sunset years. So the addendum to the story is that my Rebbe Weinberger went to far from see it in the summer. After the story broke last year, like I told you the story last year, standing right here. So it was in tablet, it was all over Facebook. It was really wild. So then in May, my Rebbe of Weinberger took a bunch of people from the shul to on a trip, and one of the places they went to, they went to Kfar Chasidim. And the caretaker over there said, you know, we don't get a lot of tourists over here. It's not on the normal list of Kfarim that people visit. So Weinberger said that we're coming here really just to say thank you to this man. And now that the story is out in the public. Because people do things in life sometimes, and they imagine that they're unredeemable. They imagine that nobody wants them, nobody likes them. They imagine this Yevlon Rebbe was living in California, thinking the entire time that all the people around him, Kfar Hasidim, hated him. They hated him. They would never want to see him again. He couldn't, in his wildest dreams, believe that anybody would want to see him again. And then in the end, what happened is that he had this whole huge welcome back. And that we hear this point and understand this point is the same amount of unbelievable chutzpah to believe that we're all lovable. To believe in Uvachem. To believe that it's possible to dream without limits. That's possible that Hashem has such love for us. That's what the Uvachem is all about. That's what the Kriyat HaTorah is all about. That's what this little story is all about. Above and beyond my wildest dreams. So let me just conclude and thank you all for coming and listening and laughing along with me. And if we could have one takeaway from this little time together, besides the Chinese food, of course, is the message of Uvachem, the message of an unbelievable, audacious hope, and a belief in a bigger and better world, and a belief in a bigger and better us, and a belief in a bigger and better love. So maybe we deserve to maybe marry a year of unbelievable blessings and hope and prayers beyond our wildest. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.